high-value targets, recorded intercepts of suspected ISIS officers working in Iraq, and many other items the CIA would have no access to otherwise, but an intrepid Saudi could obtain through his connections in the Islamist world. Kaz's intelligence had not decimated the jihadists, not by any stretch of the imagination. AQ always seemed to find new avenues for funding, and ISIS found new men to put into leadership positions. But Denny was more than satisfied with the product he was getting from Kaz. That he had to keep the close affiliation under wraps was unfortunate, but Denny knew he would never in a million years receive authorization to allow foreign operatives to work freely in the USA. The closed minds of the FBI and the political minds of the White House would be horrified if they knew. Denny understood the intel business. You had to pay to play. And he also understood what Kaz wanted. Kaz wasn't here in the U.S. running ops against the U.S. No, he was working against his country's enemies. Economic intelligence against other oil-producing states. Political intelligence against those of Saudi Arabia's Middle Eastern neighbors who swam in the waters of the United Nations, the American media, and D.C.-based think tanks. Denny had known Kaz for a long time, and although he couldn't say he trusted the man, Saudi Arabia was always looking out for the interests of Saudi Arabia, after all. Denny felt like he understood the man's motivations. Kaz wasn't running around America with a team of assassins knocking off congressmen. Allowing the Saudi intel chief some latitude to pursue his nation's objectives in the United States was, as far as Denny Carmichael was concerned, a fair price to pay for what he was getting in return. As he drove back over the Woodrow Wilson Bridge on his way to Prince George's County Airport, Denny allowed himself a moment of pride and satisfaction. He saw himself as the chess master, controlling the pieces on the board. The moment faded as he thought about Gentry. Not because Gentry was the problem at hand, no, he thought about Gentry now because in the 15 years Denny Carmichael had worked closely with Mirkan Alkazaz, there had only been one major misstep in the relationship. One time where intel from Kaz had led, for one reason or another, to an unmitigated intelligence disaster. That time was years earlier, and the end result of that intelligence failure was now running free on the streets of America. Wholly unaware of what he did to bring the full force of the U.S. intelligence community down on him like so many missiles from the sky. Mirkan Alkazaz sat quietly in the suite at the Kimpton Lorient for 20 minutes, using the time to send text messages and to clear other matters out of his inbox. Then he, too, left the suite, wiping the door latch with a handkerchief on his way out. He was picked up on Duke Street, two blocks from the hotel. He folded into the back of a Jaguar sedan, and then he was off to his office in the center of a small motorcade of unmarked Land Rovers and Escalades. Kaz stared out the window silently as they returned to the Royal Embassy of Saudi Arabia, just across New Hampshire from the Watergate complex. His offices were there at the embassy, taking up a large portion of one wing of the building. Saudi Arabia had a robust intelligence apparatus here in D.C. for three main reasons. For starters, many young Saudis came to the U.S. to study, and here they learned English and the ways of America. Kaz, therefore, had a large selection of good intelligence officers to choose from to staff his stable in D.C. Secondly, Saudi Arabia had an incredible amount of money. Liquid funds. Easily accessible U.S. dollars. Good intelligence work did not rely on money alone, of course, but money was an effective lubricant to all manner of espionage. Kaz had a budget of millions with which to buy equipment, rent real estate, and bribe men and women in all social strata in the U.S. And the third reason Saudi Arabia's intelligence service was so damn effective in the U.S. was because of the special relationship between CIA's clandestine service director Denny Carmichael and U.S. Station Chief for the Saudi General Intelligence Presidency, Mirkan Alkazaz. The secret pact between the two men stipulated that Kaz could only use his operation here in the States to target other nations, not the U.S. itself. And Kaz was not allowed to work against any of the U.S.'s main allies. Both men understood this to mean Israel, because Denny could not very well have Kaz getting caught in the district, for example, conducting surveillance on the home of the Israeli ambassador. Denny's understanding of their agreement was that Kaz and his men were free to do other types of collection. They might use long-distance listening devices against the Russian consulate to learn about oil pipeline deals. They could run collection operations on other Middle Eastern embassies to obtain information on diplomatic and military affairs important to the Saudi kingdom. And they might surveil foreign nationals dangerous to Saudi interests who were here in the district to visit think tanks or speak to aid groups or conduct protest rallies. Denny knew there was plenty for Kaz to do without conducting operations against Americans. Until now, that was. But despite Denny Carmichael's understanding of the agreement, Mirkwan Alcazaz had his own ideas about just what his men would do here in the U.S. He took advantage of the protective wing of America's top spy, and he used Denny's secret sanction to run lethal direct action missions here in the United States. His men had killed an Israeli blogger, a prominent author who wrote books critical of U.S.-Saudi relations, and a German businessman in the defense sector, who stood in the way of the kingdom obtaining a lucrative contract for aircraft engines. All the murders had been passed off as muggings, carjackings, automobile accidents, and Denny had not suspected a thing. He never understood that his friend and partner Mirkwan Alcazaz was actually more like a fox in a henhouse. And now Kaz was being asked by the most important man in American intelligence to devote all his energies to finding and killing a single American operative inside the United States of America. At first blush, it had nothing to do with Kaz's overarching mission here in the States, but Kaz would do as Denny requested because Denny Carmichael's survival was in the interests of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Chapter 13. The three fraternity brothers were stone-cold sober, but that wasn't the worst part. The worst part was that they were also wet, hungry, and pissed, and they hadn't even killed anything yet. They'd begun this weekend with such high hopes, and Friday had been a blast. It was Jay's 22nd birthday, and his father had arranged a memorable time for him and his two best friends. They left the Sig Epp house at Cleveland's Case Western Reserve Friday afternoon and headed to the airport to climb aboard a Cessna Citation Mustang that was owned by Jay's dad's law firm. The three boys sipped rum and cokes served to them by the jet's leggy flight attendant while they flew to Greenbrier Valley Airport in Lewisburg, West Virginia. From the airport, they were driven to the hunting lodge, and as soon as they checked into their rooms, they hit the bar and drank shots with a group of old-timers till late in the evening. Saturday morning, they rolled out of their bunks, groggy and hungover, but riding on adrenaline. Dressed in their new camo, they shouldered their rented rifles and heavy packs and sauntered down to breakfast. The plan called for their guide to meet them in the lobby, and then they would discuss the strategy of their full weekend wild boar hunting excursion over pancakes and bacon. The boys figured after that they would all climb onto four-wheelers, drive up into the mountains, and kill shit. Maybe do a shot of Fireball or Jägermeister every time a hog went down. But when they met the guide in the lobby by the entrance to the breakfast room, he turned them away from the food and walked them directly out into the rainy morning. When Jay asked the gruff-looking, middle-aged, bearded man what the rush to get out of the lodge was all about, he just said they would be doing less four-wheeling and more humping to get to their hide site. The three boys got the impression humping meant something different to their guide than it did to them. The man then went through each of the frat boys' gear and began pulling things out and throwing them in a pile on the gravel drive without a word. Out came the 12-pack of Natural Light, the bottles of Fireball, Jägermeister, and Pappy Van Winkle, then the M&Ms, fried pies, and even two bags of Cheetos. Jay's dad was a high-profile attorney. Meat's mom hosted a satellite radio show about Chicago politics, and Stewart's dad had been deputy mayor of Cleveland. But all three boys were too intimidated by the rough-looking guide to protest. They'd been warned at the lodge by the old-timers that the man was surly and taciturn, but along with these cons, they'd been promised he was also the best hunting guide in the state, Jay blasted an anthill that sort of looked like a boar from distance, and, although he expended a lot of ammunition, the only thing meat had killed was 3 pouches of marbled pound cake and 2 helpings of beef stew out of the MRE stash in his pack. The guide was clearly disgusted with them all, but he had not even brought a rifle of his own, so, as far as they were concerned, he couldn't prove he could have done any better. They made camp before last light and ate more MREs, and by then, the Sig Epp frat brothers had begun complaining loudly. When they did, the guide gave them the evil eye and a gruff retort about how they looked like they needed the exercise more than they needed pork chops, and then he promised them better results on Sunday. But it was Sunday now, past 2 p.m., 30 hours after setting out, and the frat boys still hadn't killed a damn thing. They sat in a hide on the side of a hill that looked down over broken ground divided by a winding creek. On the other side of the valley, some 250 yards away, sat another rocky hillside, thick with pines and brush that was lush and green in the wet spring. All 3 boys had sat silently on the cold ground for the past hour, waiting for something to happen. But Jay ended the silence when he turned to the guide and cleared his throat.
"Hey, man, this is bullshit. You promised us we'd shoot some hogs."
The bearded man covered in camo didn't even turn Jay's way. He kept looking out over the valley. Then he spit chewing tobacco on the grass between his knees.
"We're hunting, not chasing. Best when your prey comes to you."
Stuart looked at his watch.
"Any idea when that might be?"
"You just have to open your eyes, ladies. They're out there if you look."
The boys all picked up their binoculars and searched the valley floor with their lenses. They'd missed most all their shots under 200 yards, so they didn't bother to scan any farther out than that. Finally, Meat said,
"There's nothing down there but squirrels."
The guide said,
"I thought you said you kids came from Case Western. Sure you don't go to the school for the blind?"
Jay took his eyes out of his binos and looked at the guide.
"I don't want to be a dick or anything, but you know I could make one call to my dad and get you fired. He's friends with the old dude who owns the lodge, you know."
The guide spit again in the grass in front of him. Stuart finished scanning the valley floor, then he moved the glass up and searched the opposite hillside. He stopped the movement of his binoculars suddenly.
"Wait, you aren't talking about those hogs up there, are you?"
It took a minute, but Stuart got his 2 fraternity brothers to see what he was looking at. Far on the other side, and almost as high as the hunter's hide site, 8 wild boar rooted in the wet grass and pine needles. Jay said,
"You're kidding, right? Those hogs have to be 400 yards away."
The guide looked across the valley with his naked eyes.
"Not an inch more than 370. Actually, I'd say 363.
Jay pulled his brand new laser range finder out of his brand new backpack. After nearly a minute's work with the device, he retracted his eye out of the eye cup and turned to the guide, a look of astonishment on his face.
"That's incredible. The closest hog is 361.
The guide spit again.
"That one in the front is a little underdeveloped. I was talking about that big black fella about 2 meters behind him."
Meat just muttered,
"Holy shit."
Stuart said,
"But we aren't shooting from here."
A pause.
"Are we?" "Why not?"
Jay got over his awe at the guide's natural distance calculating ability.
"Look, it's your job to get us within range, not just to within sight."
The guide replied with annoyance.
"I could hit him."
Jay laughed now.
"Well, you're the fucking guide, so you're supposed to be better than us. But since you didn't even bother to bring a rifle, you can't prove it, can you?"
Meat held his bolt-action Winchester out.
"You want to take a shot? I'd like to see you try it."
The guide said,
"Why not?"
But he didn't reach for the rifle. Instead, he spit once more to the side, rolled forward from a seated position into a prone position, unzipped his camouflage jacket, and reached into the folds of his clothing. To the utter confusion of the 3 fraternity brothers in the grass next to him, he slowly drew a perfectly ordinary-looking black handgun. Jay said,
"You're crazy."
The guide did not speak. He just leveled the semi-automatic pistol out in front of him, holding it in his right hand and resting his right forearm on top of his left forearm, which he positioned perpendicular to his body on the ground. Stewart said,
"That's an impossible shot with a handgun."
The guide spoke now, but it sounded as if he was talking to himself.
"Humidity's got to be 70%, 4.5-inch barrel, 40-cal hollow point. It's got to be pretty draggy. But I've got a full-value 5-mile wind to work with. I'd say I need about a 24-foot holdover."
Meat said,
"Even if you could hit one of those hogs from here, you couldn't possibly kill it. That bullet will go an inch into its hide and get stuck in the fat or the muscle."
The guide nodded slowly, not taking his eyes off his pistol's iron sights.
"You're right. Let's do a 25.5-foot holdover. Go for the brain pan."
The three boys sat there agog, staring at the big, bearded man lying in the grass next to them. They saw the barrel of the black pistol rise just slightly.
"You are fucking nuts," muttered Jay,
but then he quickly brought his binoculars up to his eyes. The other two did the same, and they focused on the target. A single gunshot pounded the air next to them. Jay jerked his binos away from his eyes with a flinch, but he got them recentered on the dark brown hog on the far hill. The animal just stood there, his snout rooting idly in the pine needles.
"You missed," Jay said.
And then the hog shuddered, its head twitched, and it dropped snout first into the shallow hole it had been digging. It fell on its side, its legs kicked out, and then it stilled. Only then did all the other wild boar on the hillside begin running off in different directions, and seconds after that, the echo of the pistol's report made its way from the far side of the hillside to the four men. Jay, Meat, and Stewart all moved as one, eyes slowly lifted out of their binoculars and turned to the man next to them. Mouths opened slightly, but no one spoke. Zack Hightower rolled back into a sitting position, reholstered his Glock 22 on his hip under his coat, and spit in the grass. He looked over to the three sissy college boys next to him. In a tone not quite as snide as he intended, he said,
"I'll kill him for you, but I sure as shit am not going to get him for you."
Meat was the first of the three boys to speak.
"One of the old dudes in the lodge said you were in the SEALs. We thought he was full of shit."
Hightower sighed.
"You aren't in the SEALs. You are in the Navy. You are a SEAL."
Jay said,
"So you were a SEAL?"
Hightower did not answer. Instead, he cocked his head to the left and looked up to the sky.
"What is it?"
Meat asked. Zack kept looking around, trying to find the source of the engine noise he was hearing. After several seconds, he said,
"Hilo."
A black helicopter appeared over the ridge on the other side of the valley, flew past the downed wild boar, and approached the four men.
EC-130, Zack added.
Jay asked,
"What's it doing here?"
Zack smiled a little now. He couldn't help it. Then he stood, grabbed his pack, and slung it over a shoulder. He brushed some of the mud and wet leaves off his clothing.
"I do believe he's here for me."
The aircraft hovered above a rolling pasture, the flattest area on the hillside, just 100 feet away from the hunters. It lowered down onto its skids, and Zack started towards it. Jay shouted after him,
"Hey, where the hell are you going?"
Zack turned back around and snapped his fingers like he'd forgotten about the three boys sitting in the grass. He reached into his pocket, removed the keys to his pickup, and threw them overhand to Jay. He said,
"The truck is 7.5 clicks east-southeast.
Meat asked,
"Which way is that? And what's a click?"
Jay stood now.
"Wait! You can't just leave us!"
Hightower turned around and headed for the helo. Over the sound of the Eurocopter's engine, he shouted back to them,
"Call your dad! I hear he knows the old dude who owns the lodge!"
Zack Hightower climbed aboard the helicopter with a nod to the crew, nonchalant, like he'd been expecting it all day, and the helo lifted back off into the gray sky while the boys watched from below. Chapter 14. Catherine King didn't always come into the office on Sundays, but she was here today, preparing an investigative piece on a recent drone attack in Syria with a deadline of noon on Monday. She had a corner cubicle area that wasn't quite an office, but it was more than what most of the reporters at the Post got. A 10-by-10 space filled with books, magazines, newspapers, file folders, rolling duffels and backpacks, yoga mats and other fitness-related items, along with a few pictures pinned into the fabric of the wall of her cube. Catherine had never married, never had children. She'd felt sure it would happen in her 30s, and when it hadn't come to pass by her 40s, she felt sure she'd become too old and set in her ways to settle down. Now, in her 50s, she threw herself into her only real loves, her work and her yoga practice. This morning, she'd come directly from her Sunday class at Georgetown Yoga, and she sat at her desk now in full, loose-fitting exercise attire. She wasn't concerned with her appearance, because the few people who worked in the office on Sunday afternoon had known her for years, and there was no one around she was out to impress. Catherine focused on her article till a reflection in her computer monitor caused her to spin around in surprise. When she did, she found a young man with thinning blonde hair and a wispy mustache-goatee combo, a smile on his face, and a backpack over his shoulder.
"Let me guess," Catherine said as she stood and extended a hand. "You must be Andy Scholl."
"A real pleasure to finally meet you." He shook her hand eagerly. "I've followed your work since J-School, before even."
"How nice."
Catherine forced a little smile at the comment. Then she scooped a stack of manila shipping pouches off of one of the two extra chairs in her cubicle area and offered the seat to Andy. He plopped down and dropped his backpack on the floor, and she sat back down in front of her monitor, holding the pouches in her lap because she didn't want to foul up her filing system by placing them on any other surface in the messy cubicle.
"Hope you don't mind me dropping in unannounced," Andy said, looking around at the mess while he spoke.
"Not at all. Apparently you not only work nights, but you also work weekends. Is that it?"
By way of explanation, Andy said, "I'm a cops reporter." Catherine understood.
"I guess criminals don't work bankers' hours."
Andy smiled. "Only bank robbers." Catherine returned a polite smile at the joke.
"Did you find out anything new about the Brandywine Street murders?"
"The victims are all still in the hospital. One is in ICU, but I doubt they will be talking to me or the cops."
"Why do you say that?"
"They're all getting charged with possession with the intent to distribute. They will lawyer up, and their lawyers will tell them to button their lips."
"Any more from the police?"
"No description of the killer other than male, white, 30s. There was one thing that was really weird, though."
"What's that?"
"The killer left a bunch of fingerprints."
Catherine scrunched up her mouth. That didn't seem weird to her at all.
"In a symbol,"
Andy added.
"A symbol?"
"Well, a number. He used his right thumbprint to make a big number 6 on a nightstand in the room with the dead guys."
"It sounds like a calling card of some sort. Have you seen that at any other crime? A gang sign or something?"
"I haven't, and I checked a nationwide database on gang signs. A 6 by itself doesn't seem to mean anything."
"Could be a message,"
Andy said.
"You mean to the CIA?
Catherine gazed out the window and down onto 15th Street.
"I don't know."
Andy asked, "Did you find anything out about the spooks who toured the scene?"
"Jordan Mays, I told you about. The woman's name is Suzanne Brewer. She's CIA as well, in their programs and plans office. Her job is to identify threats against the agency, terrorists and such, and then task assets to eliminate the threats."
"What does she have to do with Mays?"
"No idea,"
said Catherine.
"According to my contacts, she served in Baghdad protecting facilities, and then she served in Kabul and Sana'a, Yemen. She came back to HQ 3 years ago with a lot of accolades and commendations for her work and a promotion to go with it. She has an excellent reputation in the agency."
Catherine sat quietly a moment, just thinking.
Andy did not get in the way of the process. She said,
"It makes me wonder if Mays and Brewer had information about the perpetrator last night, that he was somehow related to a threat against CIA. It would have to be something substantial to bring out the AD of NCS and a senior program officer."
"What do you want to do now?" Andy asked.
"I'd like to know more about the man they are after. I'll stay away from Carmichael for now."
Andy said,
"If you want, I can reach out to Mays, just play dumb and ask him what he was doing there."
King shook her head.
"He won't talk. At this point, the best we can hope is for an official CIA press officer comment, which would be worthless."
Andy sighed. It was clear to Catherine that he wanted a story, and he wanted it now. He said,
"In your world, you can't get people to talk. When I go to a crime scene to get an interview, I usually can't get people to shut up."
Catherine laughed.
"Do what I do long enough, and you learn to read between the lines. Often I get more information by what the CIA doesn't say."
She spun back around to her computer, indicating to Andy she was ready to get back to work.
"Keep your nose to the ground, Andy. My interest is piqued about Mays and Brewer."
Zach Hightower had been handed a garment bag in the Eurocopter, and in it he found a suit and tie. The control officer on board asked him to change out of his hunting gear, not because CIA demanded formality, but rather so he did not draw attention to himself in the building dressed in camo and muddy boots. He stripped down to his boxers as they flew high over Northern Virginia, and as he did so, he could immediately tell his new outfit had been borrowed off another man. It didn't fit very well around his muscular arms, and there was a hint of both antiperspirant and BO. Zack smelled like a goat, however, so he just shrugged and put on the suit. The control officer kicked off his own wingtips, and Zack slipped them on, finding them just one size too small. The Hilo descended over the rolling hills of Virginia and landed on CIA property at 7 p.m., setting down in the nearly empty parking lot on the bubble side of the old HQ building. Even before the rotors spooled down, Zack was led out and then through the side door. He followed his control officer through the security checks, then to the elevators, where he stepped inside. The Langley headquarters was familiar to him, but only from visits for an occasional briefing, seminar, or retirement party for a senior co-worker. He'd never had a desk here, and as far as Zack was concerned, that was okay with him. He raised an eyebrow when he realized they were heading up to the 7th floor. Zack worked for the Central Intelligence Agency for 11 years before being dismissed, but this was his first trip all the way to the top. 7 wasn't exactly a hangout for paramilitary operations officers, after all. Zack had spent the majority of his stateside time with CIA in training, mostly in Virginia and North Carolina, but also in the mountains of Montana and Colorado, firing ranges in Mississippi and Arizona, the deserts of Nevada, and the streets of D.C., where he and other SAD men honed their surveillance skills. Zack's unit of ground branch officers did have its own headquarters, an unmarked building in Norfolk, Virginia. But Zack had spent several years leading his six-man outfit of shooters to all points in the war on terror, and in those years, he and his team spent very little time stateside. As he rode the elevator up with the other man, Zack did his best to act like this sort of shit happened to him every day, but in truth, his mind was racing. Why were they pulling him in? Some old op needed a full accounting? Some new op needed the eyes of a veteran to straighten it out? Was he being offered a way back in the CIA? Hightower didn't dare hope for this. A minute later, Zack took a seat at a mahogany table in a dark-paneled conference room, and within moments of his sitting down, a side door opened, and in walked Jordan Mays, the second in command at NCS. Zack was surprised to see such a high flyer, but more surprised that Jordan Mays looked like hell, as if he'd been up for 48 hours. Hightower knew Mays from both of their days in SAD, although Mays had always been enough rungs higher on the management ladder to where he didn't need to slum with labor much.
From time to time, Hightower would find himself face to face with Maze, but he could count those occurrences on one hand. Zack knew Maze had always worked directly for Denny Carmichael. He hoped that was no longer the case. Carmichael had fired Zack a couple of years earlier, unceremoniously and cruelly. Hightower had been in intensive care at the time with a gunshot wound to his chest and a dangerous infection in his lungs, and Carmichael sent word down through a low-level flunky that his services would no longer be required. Zack had been devastated by this, but he was a good soldier. He filed no protest. He made no complaint. He just lay alone in the hospital till the doctors released him. Then he went home from the hospital to his apartment in Virginia Beach and did nothing but lay there and watch TV. For a year. He had no family other than an ex-wife who lived somewhere in Colorado with a daughter Zack had never met. So he basically sat at home and recuperated, watched the news, and wished he was still part of it. He'd only picked up the hunting guide gig in West Virginia when he ran out of money. He hated shepherding rich assholes through the woods just so they could shoot a fucking pig that wasn't bothering anybody. But the money was good, and all the hiking, climbing, and shooting had molded Zack into reasonably good shape within a short period of time. He'd fantasized about getting back on, if not with CIA, at least with some private military company. But Carmichael had stripped Zack's top-secret clearance, so Zack knew no real PMC would touch him. He had no interest in doing stateside static security work, so he just kept hauling rich civvies out on wild boar hunts, hoping something interesting would happen in his life. And now he was face-to-face with the number two spy at the agency on the seventh floor of the old HQB. This was, at the very least, interesting. Zack Hightower stood smartly, not quite at attention, but certainly displaying a show of respect. Maze nodded and sat down after a quick handshake. Under his arm, he carried a thick file, and Zack suspected that his operational life and perhaps his post-operational life would be in that file.
"Thanks for coming in," Maze said. "Happy to help in any way I can." "Denny wants a word."
Zack swallowed.
"Can I ask what this is about?"
"Better if Denny gives it to you cold."
Carmichael pushed open the side door and all but stormed up to the table. If he had pulled an all-nighter with Maze the evening before, then he was clearly a vampire, because Zack thought he looked good to go now at 7 p.m. Zack stood. This time it was at full military attention. Carmichael's greeting was, to say the least, several degrees cooler than that of Jordan Maze.
"I don't do apologies, Hightower, so if you're waiting for one, prepare to be disappointed."
Zack followed Carmichael by sitting back down and pulling himself up to the table.
"Not expecting one, sir." "You aren't pissed about what happened to you 2 years ago?"
Zack shook his head.
"I failed on a mission. That was unacceptable to you, but it was also unacceptable to me. I would have been disappointed if you'd not released me after that."
Carmichael took in the comment, then asked,
"Fitness-wise, where are you?"
100%.
Zack realized his tone had sounded hopeful, and he told himself to keep it flat till he knew what the hell was going on. Carmichael looked to Maze now. Maze shrugged. Hightower clarified.
"Took a handgun round center mass 2 years ago, but I've recovered. Been shooting every day. Long range, I'm better than ever. Running some, too. I'm not 20 anymore, but that's an asset, not a liability. I'll get any job done you need me to do."
Carmichael looked doubtful.
"I can run a PT course right now." "I'm questioning your mental state." "My head is right, sir. I could put my hand in a candle and show you, if that's what you are looking for." "That's not what I want, either. I need to see that there are no hard feelings about what happened 2 years ago."
"None at all, sir." Carmichael drummed his fingers on the table for a moment. Then he seemed to let it go, and he went immediately to the subject at hand.
"Cortland Gentry appeared in the D.C. area last night."
Hightower had planned on keeping a cool, stoic face, no matter what craziness Carmichael threw his way.
but now he could not hide his surprise.
Oh, shit! Killed two drug dealers in the slums, apparently to obtain money to finance his activities here.
Only two? Zack quipped. The execs stared back at him, so he went on the defensive.
Look, if you think I knew about this, then you...
Carmichael interrupted.
Any idea why he might have come here?
Permission to speak freely, sir?
This isn't the fucking Navy, Hightower.
Zack shrugged, as if the answer was obvious.
He's come here to kill you.
It was silent in the dark conference room for a moment, and Hightower worried he might have overstepped his bounds. Then May said,
That's our assessment as well.
Hightower nodded slowly, and a smile grew. Suddenly, it felt like all his problems had just melted away. The past 2 years of his life, the depression born out of being ostracized by the agency after failing a mission, disappeared. He had a job, a purpose. The old Zack was back. With a wide grin, he said,
I get it. I get why I'm here. You need me to stop him.
Carmichael sniffed.
Don't get ahead of yourself. You didn't stop him last time out, did you?
The cocky smile remained.
Sir, that op you sent me on in Sudan was as wrong as dick cancer, and you know it.
Denny Carmichael did not reply to this. After a moment, he said,
We brought you in to see if you could help us determine where Gentry might be, what he might do, tactics and the like.
Damn straight. Nobody knows him like I do.
After a gentle rapping on the side door, a woman in a conservative blue outfit entered. Zack's first impression was that she was hot. Not stripper hot, he told himself, but hot in sort of a sexy librarian kind of way. She walked up to Hightower, who fought the urge to look her up and down. Instead, he stood up, and she extended her hand. Jordan Mays made the introductions.
Hightower, this is Suzanne Brewer. She is the officer in charge of the Violator Tactical Operations Center. As long as Gentry is in this area of operations, she is tasked with finding him. We'd like you to spend some time telling her everything you know about the man, his tactics, techniques, and procedures. Together, you can fine-tune the hunt so the shooters know where to go.
Zack was disappointed. A minute earlier, he would have been happy plunging the toilets here at CIA, but now he wanted in on the hunt itself.
Who are your shooters? Ground Branch? He asked.
Negative. We are using JSOC, Carmichael said. They are already out on the streets. Until we have a positive sighting of him, we won't have anything more than what you and Suzanne can develop.
Why not Ground Branch?
We are keeping Matt Hanley out of this for now.
Hightower nodded slowly. There was some sort of intra-office feud going on between Hanley and Carmichael. This Hightower could see on Carmichael's face. Hightower put aside his desire to run and gun, and he nodded to the hottie in the business suit.
I look forward to working with you, Ms. Brewer.
He'd do more than that if he got the chance.
Suzanne is fine, she said,
and from her tone he instantly realized he would not get the chance. Despite the first name, this one was all business.
The operations center is on the fourth floor. I have an office there where we can talk further. Violator has been in country about 20 hours, so we don't have a moment to lose.
Then let's get started.
Mays said.
That's it, Hightower? You haven't asked for anything. No money, no request for us to clarify your status. Why not?
Hightower did not hesitate in his reply.
I understand what's happening. This isn't just about bringing me in to discuss Gentry's habits. No, you need a guy like me on the street, in the hunt. You want me to remain off book. Better that way for you. If this breaks bad with a running shootout down the National Mall, you don't want to be tied to it. You are bringing me on to help with TTPs, but if he's located on U.S. soil, you'd rather some nobody like me went out and did the killing.
Not a special mission unit tied to the military, or an operative tied to the intelligence community.
You want some loser you can leave swinging in the wind in case you need to deny responsibility.
No one said a word for an awkward moment. Then Zack added,
And I'm good with that.
Carmichael and Mays exchanged a look.
Finally, Carmichael reached a hand across the table.
Good to see you again, Hightower.
The two men shook hands, and Zack looked to Brewer.
How about you and me go find that son of a bitch?
Chapter 15. Court Gentry accomplished more in his first day back in the United States than most could accomplish in a month. After sleeping 5 hours, he rolled out of bed and looked through his small driveway-level window, checking for any new cars or strange people wandering the neighborhood. Atmospherics and patterns of life. The more he knew about his area of operations, the easier it would be for him to notice something that did not belong. But he saw nothing that triggered his threat radar, so he folded a massive wad of $20 bills into his pocket, left his rented room, and walked to a discount department store a mile away. Here, he filled a shopping cart with clothing in just minutes because he knew what he was doing. There were few people on planet Earth more skilled at changing their look on the fly, and Court knew the colors, styles, and sizes he needed to make himself invisible in a crowd. The temperatures in D.C. this time of year fluctuated between the low 40s and the mid-60s, with periods of rain nearly every day, so Court knew he could fit in with others on the street by wearing several layers. With two long-sleeve shirts, a dark green baseball cap, a beige knit cap, and a brown hoodie under a reversible black raincoat, Court could, in under a second, switch between 7 different and distinct looks as he walked down the street. He bought 6 complete sets of clothing and 2 nondescript black backpacks, 2 different pairs of cheap sunglasses, brown work boots and rubber overshoes, a small fanny pack, a $10 digital watch, and a quality kitchen knife with a plastic sheath. Near the Columbia Heights metro station, he found an electronics chain store, and here Court bought a tablet computer and a battery charger, 2 contract-free smartphones, and a few other gadgets. He'd done this sort of thing many times before, of course, in Ireland, in Brazil, in Laos, in Russia. But it felt different prepping for action here in the USA. He made a stop at his room to drop off his shopping bags and change into some of his new clothes. Then he walked to a hardware store and bought a high-end glass cutter, a multi-tool, a tool kit, a tool belt, binoculars, a small hacksaw, a rain parka, and more work clothes in colors and fashions that would help him fit into the fabric of the city, as a construction worker or some non-specific manual laborer. At all 3 stores, he was pleased to see he could make his purchases without having to speak to a single human being. No one in the stores asked to help him, and instead of going to cash registers, he could instead scan his own items, bag them, and pay a machine. Court liked his chances of keeping a low profile if he could conduct as much of his business as possible with automation. At a convenience store, he purchased food and water, a prepaid Visa card loaded with $500, and 2 more contract-free phones. He returned to the safe house below the Mayberry's home, and he dumped his new gear and clothing on the bed. He then knelt down in the narrow closet and felt around the paneling that had been damaged from the moisture and heat from the water heater on the other side. He rapped gently next to it until he found a 2-foot square section that sounded completely hollow. Using his hacksaw, he punched through the paneling on a seam, then he began cutting. In minutes, he had created a small and nearly undetectable escape hatch into the Mayberry's basement proper. He grabbed his flashlight and crawled through to the pitch-black basement, expecting to be able to stand up immediately, but shining the light around, he saw he was in a 3-foot-high channel that passed below some water pipes next to the home's old water heater. Court followed the crawl space for 6 feet before he was able to stand up next to the furnace. Looking around the main section of the basement, he got the distinct impression the Mayberries didn't spend a great deal of time down here. A thick coating of dust covered most parts of the room, except for the area near the wooden staircase up to the ground floor. Here, a shelving unit was filled with canned goods, paper towels, toilet paper, and cases of soft drinks. In the flashlight's beam, Court found Arthur Mayberry's workbench, along with a good selection of tools, most lying around haphazardly.
Court could tell Mayberry was something of a handyman, which was no surprise considering this was an older home and probably required a lot of upkeep. There was a propane tank for a gas grill and a few lawn care items that Mayberry inexplicably stored down here instead of in the little shed at the end of the driveway that Court had noticed that morning. Taking stock of all the equipment in the room, Court had an idea about how he could improve his defensive position in the little basement studio apartment. He shook the propane tank to make sure it was full, and then a slight smile drew across his face as he formulated his plan. Using his toolkit to disassemble some items that did not look like they would be missed by the Mayberries in the short term, he made two trips on his hands and knees, bringing all the equipment back to his rented room through the tiny crawl space. He then left his room again, running out to a nearby sporting goods store to buy everything he needed to finish his project. While at the sporting goods store, he picked up a Walker's Game Ear, a behind-the-ear device not unlike a hearing aid, used by hunters to hear the faint sound of game in the woods. Court had used similar devices with CIA, and although he expected this over-the-counter bit of technology to be a little inferior to the top-secret kit he'd used in the field, he knew it would help him pick up distant conversation or alert him to anyone trying to sneak up behind him whenever he had it in place. He returned and spent the next hour building a booby trap, rigging it to slow down or even stop anyone trying to make their way in through the one door to the room. He designed the entire contraption so he could break it down and hide it in minutes when he left the house, in case the Mayberries themselves decided to drop in. Satisfied his device was functional, Court checked his watch. It was already 7 p.m. He logged onto the internet via his 4G mobile phone and surfed to a computer hacking website. Here, he downloaded an open-source copy of AirCrack NG, a Wi-Fi password cracking tool that used brute force to guess logins to Wi-Fi networks. When the software was ready on his phone, he searched for all nearby Wi-Fi signals and found four that were strong enough for him to use here in his basement room. He chose one, then initiated AirCrack NG. The software began running its algorithm to determine the password, trying hundreds of thousands of combinations against the targeted network. After several minutes without success, he gave up on the first network, determining that whoever selected the password had done an excellent job. Most people spent little time creating passwords, and it was a rare occurrence when AirCrack NG failed to discover it. He moved on to the second network. This time, AirCrack NG divined the code in less than 3.5 minutes, so Court then logged on to the neighbor's network with both his phone and his tablet. Once online, he turned his attention to Craigslist, the classified advertising website. He spent less than 15 minutes on the site before making a series of phone calls, then heading back out into the night. He took a cab to an address in nearby Petworth, and here he bought a 1998 gray Ford Escort for $1,100 from a private seller. Although the car was old, it had a reasonable 145,000 miles on it, and there were no major dents or scratches that could make the vehicle easy to ID by trained surveillance. The seller said he was selling the car cheap because he'd lost his copy of the title, but he assured Court it wasn't stolen. It would be a tremendous understatement to say Court was skeptical in nature, but in this case, he actually believed the man, because he saw from the listing the car had been for sale for over a month, and he knew police trolled Craigslist looking for stolen vehicles. He drove the little four-door back to Reagan Washington National Airport, and here he parked in a long-term lot. He wandered around for a moment, then dropped down behind a vehicle parked rear-in against a back wall. He removed the car's Maryland license plate, attached it to his Escort, and then left the airport. It took him another hour to purchase a motorcycle. He found a black-on-silver Yamaha 650 XS on Craigslist. It was almost as old as Court himself and had some issues, but it was fast, perfectly nondescript, and, after a bit of haggling, only $750. The seller tossed in a helmet and a plate he had lying on a workbench off another old project bike of his.
Court rented a 12-by-12 storage unit within walking distance of his room and parked both vehicles inside, along with one of his two backpacks, this one filled with clothes. By 10 p.m., Court was back in his basement apartment and back on his tablet computer, calling up a website called uscrypto.org. Even surfing through the pages of the site made the former American intelligence operative feel dirty. U.S. Crypto was the brainchild of a group of self-proclaimed anarchists and fervent anti-Americans, and it billed itself as an online library and repository for stolen and hacked classified documents, information about secret intelligence sites and personnel, and articles, photos, and videos that it claimed proved illegal U.S. intelligence eavesdropping. One subsite on uscrypto.org was called Spycatcher, and Court clicked the link to take him there. On the pages contained in the subsite, U.S. crypto employees revealed the addresses of secret government facilities and the names and home addresses of employees of American intelligence. The site even provided Google Maps Street View images of the homes of clandestine personnel. All this information was divined from open sources by U.S. crypto staff, so it was completely legal, but the very existence of Spycatcher made Court sick to his stomach. The site could easily serve and had probably already been used as a tool by terrorists and other agents provocateur to allow them to physically target installations and personnel. But now uscrypto.org was an asset to Gentry, because he found himself in an adversarial relationship with his former employer. It occurred to him that, if he were still working for CIA, he would love to be assigned to target the founder and author of this website, because the head of uscrypto.org was certainly a danger to every man and woman who worked in the U.S. intelligence community. Court would think nothing of killing the founder, although Court had never killed for his country on U.S. soil. Court searched for the names of several people, and he found only one, because although uscrypto.org was good, Court's old associates at CIA were among the blackest of the black. He jotted down the address, pulled out his phone, and recorded it all on a mapping application. He also looked up addresses for several clandestine government contractors. There he had more luck, and he noted these on a pad and in his phone. Quickly, he ate a microwave enchilada and drank a bottle of water. As soon as he was done, he took off his shirt, grabbed the hacksaw off of the little kitchen counter, and sat on the edge of his bed. Court slowly and carefully began sawing the cast off his right arm. Less than a month earlier, he'd taken a handgun round straight into his forearm, snapping the ulna in two. His doctor's orders were to leave the cast on for 6 weeks, and it had been less than four, but Court decided the time was right to free himself of this annoying burden. He'd have to be careful with it, of course. The broken bone and soft tissue had healed, more or less, but there was still some more growing together that needed to happen, and certain high-stress actions to his arm could quite easily re-injure it. But Court knew his body. It came from a lifetime of hurting it and watching it heal. He knew he could go without the cast as long as he was careful with the arm, and he also knew he was out of time. Each and every day he remained in the U.S. with the CIA's shoot-on-sight sanction in effect, he compounded the risk. He had to begin his operation now. He didn't have time to nurse his wounds. As soon as Court had the cast off his arm, he put on several layers of his darkest clothing, loaded his pockets with gear, and headed back out into the night. He'd already had a busy day, but his real mission was only now about to begin. Chapter 16. Chris Travers ordered his fourth shot of Jameson at last call. Then he polished off the last few gulps of his draft beer. He'd been drinking since before 10 p.m. It was nearly 1 a.m. now, and he wanted one more for the road, or more precisely, one more for the six-block walk back to his apartment. This was Travers's favorite pub, and he was a regular here, but he drank alone now. A couple of mates had sat with him for the first round, but they had to push off because the next day was Monday, and after all, who really hung out sipping whiskey till closing time on a Sunday night? Chris Travers did, because he didn't work a 9-to-5 job. For large swaths of the year, he was on the clock 24/7, and for other sizable chunks of the year, he was in training and away from home. But for a few precious weeks here and there, he was free from training, off from deployment, and on his own to do whatever the hell he wanted to do with his time. And this evening, he was determined to take advantage of one of the all-too-rare respites. He held the whiskey up to the little light hanging over the bar of the Irish pub to appreciate the amber color, and while he did this, he looked out the window into the night. By force of habit, he always kept an eye open, even here in the States. He was surprised to see trash blowing down 19th Street. There had been only the lightest breeze when Travers headed out to the pub hours earlier, so he'd not bothered to dress for warmth. He'd just thrown on a flannel shirt and khaki pants and boat shoes with no socks. Suddenly, he found himself regretting his rare moment of poor preparation. He'd not thought twice about making the 6-block walk down here from his apartment to the Irish whiskey, because Chris Travers had braved elements a hell of a lot more severe than a D.C. spring. His mind took him back to a mountain in Pakistan, where he'd once spent 3 days in temperatures below zero. He'd handled that without a second thought. Granted, at the time he'd been under fire from Taliban snipers, so he had bigger fish to fry than catching a chill. But still, he told himself, tonight's 10-minute hump back to his apartment would be no big deal. Travers had joined the army out of high school, served 2 years in straight-legged infantry, and with that, 3 tours of Iraq. He then earned his way into the Green Berets, spending 3 more years in 7th Special Forces Group. From there, he left the military and went straight into the CIA, found his way to SAD Ground Branch, and, with his paramilitary unit, he had deployed all over the world for the past 10 years. This had been a life well spent, but he had a long-term plan for his life ahead, too. He'd earned his private and commercial pilot's licenses along the way, and, he told himself, once he got too old or too beat up for the shooting and scooting life, he'd stay with the agency, flying spooks and techs all over the world as a pilot for Air Branch. But that was somewhere in the future. For now, he was between deployments, spending his evening alone in a bar, and thinking about all his mates who didn't make it back home from Iraq, and from a dozen other shitholes of the world. He'd lost a lot of good friends, and he always dedicated his last drink of the night to them. Then he gave a silent wave to the bartender, a little wink to the waitress, whose attractiveness, like the wind outside, had increased dramatically in the time he'd been sitting on a bar stool drinking, and he headed out into the blustery night. His apartment was on Florida, several blocks north, and it was directly into the wind, so he jammed his hands into his pockets and leaned into it as he climbed the hill. There were next to no pedestrians out on a Sunday night, but he was careful to keep watch for movement on the sidewalk or on the street, ready to give a scrutinizing eye to anyone or anything that looked out of place. He wasn't aware of any specific threats, but men like Travers had personal security and counter-surveillance techniques trained into their muscle memory. He saw nothing out of the ordinary. Court Gentry was completely enshrouded in his hoodie and neck gaiter. Only his eyes, forehead, and the bridge of his nose remained visible. His hands were stuffed in his pockets, and he kept his head low into the wind. He stood on the sidewalk, 3 doors down from Chris Travers's apartment, and he waited for his target to appear, walking back from the pub. Once he saw the man in the distance make the turn onto Florida, he tucked himself into a little alley that ran south off the street, found the deepest and darkest place, well out of the wind, and waited with his hand on the pistol in his jacket pocket. He imagined Travers was probably a little drunk, but Court also knew the majority of the effects of the alcohol would disappear almost instantly when the adrenaline kicked in. So he knew he had to presume Travers would remain formidable. Court was also aware Travers would be hardwired with every counter-surveillance protocol and tactic known to man, and he would treat everyone he saw as a potential adversary. That said, Travers